Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Security Ledger podcast. I'm your host, Paul Roberts, the editor-in-chief and publisher at the Security Ledger. With the Labor Day holiday here, summer has unofficially ended, and that means returning to a long list of items put down and marked to do back in May and June. This week on the Security Ledger, we're catching up with our to-do list. Top of the list, right to repair legislation that was put on hold back in the spring in a number of states. We're going to take a look at Massachusetts, a state that passed the nation's first right to repair law for automobiles and is looking to expand those protections to a wide range of connected devices. Also, we're going to talk to the member of a team of computer scientists from the University of California, Berkeley, that won Facebook's $100,000 Internet Defense Prize, their invention, a new and better way to spot spear phishing emails. And finally, the Mirai botnet taught us that internet-connected devices like cameras and digital video recorders can be a big problem when they're pulled together in massive botnets. Cyber criminals got the message loud and clear, and these connected devices are now one of the top targets of online attacks. How common are such attacks? We're going to talk with Johannes Ulrich of the Internet Storm Center, who did some research on the topic. The results may surprise you. But first, Massachusetts has been the first in the nation for many of the most important legal advances of the last 20 years, including the nation's first right to repair law that required automakers to make both software tools and diagnostic codes available to both vehicle owners and independent repair shops, not just those licensed by the manufacturer. A bill to expand that law to cover a wider range of devices was shelved last spring, but is expected to be heard again this fall. We invited Kyle Weens of iFixit.org and Repair.org into the Security Ledger studio to talk about efforts to expand right to repair protections to other kinds of products. As Ween sees it, the right to repair extends well beyond vehicles to products of all types.
So the campaign is based on the auto bill that was passed in 2012. The only issue we have with that bill is that it only covered automotive, and we think that this is an issue that applies to all products, not just cars. So this is a broader bill that's designed to cover Internet of Things, cell phones, farm equipment, medical equipment, and it's a fundamental question of who has control of a product. Is it the product owner that controls it, or is it the original manufacturer?
Kyle, you see the right to repair as part of a much larger problem in the U.S., which is the near extinction of the repair industry for a wide range of consumer devices like televisions and cameras. You think it's not about changing consumer preferences, but about more straightforward issues like the access to aftermarket replacement parts. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is a major issue. What's happened is you have waves of repair shops that come and go. There used to be TV repair shops. They went away at the beginning of the 90s because the manufacturers stopped making parts and schematics available. And then there were camera repair shops, and most of the camera repair shops went out of business 3-4 years ago when Nikon stopped selling them service parts. And at the moment, we have cell phone repair shop, but they're not necessarily going to stick around a long time unless we can build in some kind of rate to repair. We wouldn't have local auto repair shops if it weren't for existing rate to repair laws.
You think that we can see evidence of this dynamic today just in the market for cell phone repairs, and you note that getting an iPhone fixed by an independent repair shop is not that hard, but that it's much harder to get Android phones repaired. Why is that?
None of the phone manufacturers sell parts to the aftermarket. So the only reason that the iPhone repair market is viable is because there's aftermarket parts from outside factories. But that's not the case with a lot of the other Android products. I mean, with phones, people need batteries. And, you know, the manufacturers won't sell you a battery directly. So you have to turn to online sources, or they just end up getting a new phone when their battery wears out every year and a half. One of the things that we're hoping the bill will change is start to get more of a market out there for other kinds of repairs. If you go into most repair of those cell phone repair shops, they'll fix iPhones and really nothing else. And that's substantially due to a lack of parts and information.
Kyle, many of the states pursuing the right to repair laws are in the Midwest. You say that's because the agriculture industry is very exposed to this kind of manufacturer lock-in for repair and servicing. Could you talk about that?
So for farmers, the tractors are very sophisticated. They've got touch screens in them and full-on stereo equipment. They're really nice. There are limits to how much the farmer can do without access to John Deere's Service Advisor software, which runs on a laptop. You plug it into the tractor, and then you can set parameters and clear error codes. Kind of like having an OBD scanner on a car, but there's no equivalent of that for farmers. There's all kinds of things that farmers are used to being able to do, repairs they're accustomed to being able to do with their equipment that they can't. And it's such an issue for them that the older tractors, actually the ones without computers, are holding their value at a much better level than the new ones with computers in them, because there's so many farmers that want the old equipment.
Kyle, you note that Apple is among the most prominent opponents to right-to-repair laws in the States. Talk about the company's opposition to right-to-repair.
Yeah, Apple showed up in Nebraska and told the legislators there that if it passed, it would turn Nebraska into a mecca for hackers. So you tell me how, you know, making repair diagnostics available opens a security issue. So yeah, they show up behind the scenes. Fortunately, the legislators that are supporting this have been pretty willing to talk to the public about what they're hearing and what they're seeing, because if they weren't, nobody would know how, you know, Apple in particular. I mean, it's just a pure profit grab. They told legislators in New York that they were totally willing to support right to repair as long as it didn't apply to phone glass.
Kyle, you think a legally guaranteed right to repair is critical, especially with the Internet of Things really taking root in our homes and businesses? And you think that eventually responsibility for managing connected devices is going to shift away from manufacturers and to consumers. Could you talk about that?
Well, I think there's two categories of Internet of Things devices. There's abandonware, and then there's devices that are supported, but the manufacturers just aren't providing enough tooling to product owners. Abandonware, it's really hard to deal with. I don't think this is going to solve that problem. But if we had the diagnostic tools, I mean, you ought to be able to go in and root these things and swap out the software that came with it with, you know, something like DDWRT or some open source tool where you actually could continue to secure it. So I think over time, at some point, the responsibility for securing these IoT devices has to go away from the manufacturer and come onto the product owner. But in order for me to be able to secure my, say, 5-year-old internet-connected camera, I need to be able to wipe out the manufacturer's software and put something more secure on there. One thing I've been saying is, hey, you know, as you have Internet of Things, it gets complicated. People don't know how to update the software on their refrigerator. People aren't going to be able to make their own decisions. People need help. They're not going to be able to sort these things out by themselves. And so if you can enable local repair shops to also help with security issues with all of these connected devices, that's the only way that you're going to get all of the, you know, IoT devices in people's homes patched, as if a professional comes in and does them all.
Kyle Weens, thanks for taking the time to come in and speak with the Security Ledger. We enjoyed having you.
Good talking to you, Paul.
Up next, spear phishing emails are among the most feared threats to organizations. Sophisticated and tailored to their audience, they carry malicious links or attachments and can be almost impossible to spot. So how do you stop them? Vern Paxson, a professor of electrical engineering and computer sciences at the University of California, Berkeley, is part of a team that has developed a new method for identifying spear phishing emails. He says that spear phishing email campaigns present a particular challenge to companies, but they aren't impossible to spot.
We're talking about 2 years worth of work here. So it took a long time to figure out what are all the different facets of the emails and the web access that we could effectively figure out how to leverage to winnow down all those emails to a much smaller subset of sort of iffy, you know, genuinely iffy emails. And we don't detect spearfish, you know, directly. So it's not like our detector says these dozen things are spear phishing attacks and these other 300 million are not. Rather, we winnow down the 300 million to a much smaller number that an analyst then actually looks at. Part of the benefit of our approach is that the analyst can look at these very quickly, because the things we find that are not spear phish are usually immediately apparent as not spear phish. They're types of spam or types of automated nags and things like that, that the analysts, we timed it. It literally spends just a few seconds typically to say that can't be a spearfish.
And just to give the listeners an idea, you had a body of 370 million emails, and after running this through, what you ended up with was 6 known spearfishing campaigns that succeeded, 9 additional campaigns that were not successful, and then two successful spear phishing attacks that the lab previously had not detected. So we're talking about 17 email campaigns, I guess, out of 370 million emails. That is a tiny percentage.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very small needle in a very large haystack. So in getting there, we would winnow down how much the analyst had to look at each day to 10 or fewer possible emails. We structured our whole detection approach around that number. So how much are you willing to be bugged?
Is there a danger that you're, as you tighten the filter to get that down to a very small number, that you're letting go some false negatives or emails that are worth investigation that could be spear phishing attacks that just don't meet your strict criteria?
Yeah, that's the entire art, is to balance that. And when working on detectors, you know, what we've learned is you almost never have a perfect detector. You're always making these trade-offs, so you want to make them prudently. The fact that we found all the ones in the incident database was very encouraging because that database was gathered using completely different techniques than what we used. There's also, and it always comes up, the question of evasion and whether an attacker who knows how our scheme works could then undermine it. And they can. It's really qualitatively a lot more work for them than what they currently have to do. And that's how it works in the detection business. We generally have bulletproof approaches. We generally can raise the bar significantly, the cost for the attacker.
So Facebook awarded you the $100,000 prize. What are the implications for this technology for large social media networks such as Facebook or WhatsApp or Slack, those types of platforms?
So there's two ways to think about that. Those sites and many other web services have internal security issues they need to deal with. You know, Facebook, it's vital for Facebook to secure its own internal access to its systems. Same with Google. Same with pretty much anybody. And so those companies are quite interested in exploring using this detection as part of their internal security. For their user-facing security, such as, you know, how do we protect our social network users from being spearfished, the ideas are applicable, but the particulars shift. Now, instead of thinking about this email suspicious or unusual, one has to think about this message sent through the platform was unusual in some fashion, and make sure that it's possible to get visibility into how the user responds to it.
And finally, Vern Paxson, for companies who haven't deployed technology like this, are there things that companies can do to increase their ability to detect spear phishing attacks or to fend off or discourage spear phishing attacks against their employees or customers?
There are several steps to take. A basic one is using two-factor authentication for certain forms of access. And in fact, I feel like any internet-based resource one wants to take seriously, one needs to turn on two-factor if it's an option. So that will help. There's ways to spearfish certain types of two-factor authentication, so it doesn't fix everything. Many sites resort to training and to red team attacks where they'll actually spearfish their own employees, and then for those who fall for it, debrief them and attempt to educate them on what happened. And there are some techniques, some fairly basic common techniques for eliminating certain types of spoofed emails. So that specific threat of spearfish coming from fake email, one can at least make it without too much effort. A site can make it very difficult to fake up that the email actually came from the site. Like securityledger.com, it would be impossible for an attacker to actually stick that in the from field and have your servers accept it.
Vern Paxson, Professor of Electrical Engineering and Computer Sciences at the University of California, Berkeley, and co-founder and chief scientist at CoreLight. Thank you so much for coming on the Security Ledger podcast.
Thanks a bunch. It was a pleasure.
And finally, how big a target are connected devices like cameras? Johannes Ulrich of the SANS Institute's Internet Storm Center came into the Security Ledger studios to talk about an experiment he conducted to measure attacks on one common piece of hardware, digital video recorders.
Yeah, so what I did is I used a DVR, and this is one of those security camera DVRs, so another one of your TV DVRs, that I bought a year ago, and I used a factory default configuration connected it to my small business cable modem and just waited for what happened. Now, within basically a few minutes, on average 2 minutes, this DDR got compromised just by essentially another bot logging into it using the well-known default password for this DDR.
Right. And so these would be the types of devices that are deployed if you have a business that has a security camera and it's capturing video and storing it for review later. These are the types of hardware devices that would store that video, right?
Correct. You often see them also in small businesses. They're pretty cheap. I think I paid like $50 for it without the cameras. And the problem here is they're often exposed to the internet, in particular in small businesses. If you, for example, have a security camera, a security company that then wants to review the images, that's why you expose them. They often also expose themselves using universal plug and play, which is a feature in many firewalls that can be used by these devices to automatically open up ports.
How many infections did you experience or record?
It was almost kind of 2 days I had it on for. I had, I believe it was something like 1,200 different infections that I recorded during that time.
So it was more or less constant that this device was being attacked.
Yep.
Were all those attacks just default password guessing, or were there brute force attacks or other types of attacks you recorded?
It was all default password guessing. There's a small number of passwords that's being attempted. So in some ways, it is a brute force attack. But typically, they're only trying like 3, 4, maybe 5 different passwords. And one of them is this well-known default password, XC3511.
So a couple issues, and one of which you brought up is around how these devices are deployed. And you were saying that often companies and often the end users here who are deploying these cameras are working through third-party security companies to set up the cameras and manage them. Often these companies are not deploying them in a secure fashion, in other words, behind a firewall. They are leaving them accessible to the public internet so that they can remotely connect to them and manage them. And maybe, I guess, the idea is they don't have to deal with the hassle of configuring the firewall to allow for that. Is that right?
Correct. Configuring firewalls, it's possible. It's not terribly difficult. But in particular, to make video streaming working and such, that sometimes requires special features in the firewall to make it work reliable. So what often happens is that these devices are just exposed to the internet in something that some firewalls call like an exposed server or a DMC.
And how many of these, let's say, take the model of camera, of DVR rather, that you use? I mean, how many of these are out there on the internet?
There are probably exposed probably hundreds of thousands out there. Now, it's not just the DVRs. There are also routers, for example, that I've observed that were attacking my DVR that are pretty much susceptible to the same vulnerability, which is that they have an exposed telnet or SSH server with a well-known default password.
And the end users here, the individuals or businesses that have these cameras deployed, they don't inquire about the security of the camera and DVR deployment, correct?
Correct. And there is often no clear note within instructions on how to deploy these devices. It just states to expose them to the internet in order to, for example, remote review the video footage.
And finally, Johannes, what does this really mean for the broader Internet of Things that we're hearing a lot about? These DVRs figured prominently in the Mirai botnet that popped up almost a year ago. As you said, there are a lot of them. But is this a more generic problem out there, or is it really specific to these cameras?
No, it's a very generic problem. There are many devices out there that are configured in a way that can be trivially exploited. And really, it's just the tip of the iceberg. Currently, we see a lot of focus on the weak usernames and passwords. But for example, a lot of the cameras that have built-in web servers, they also have vulnerable APIs that can easily be exploited. So there's really a large part of this iceberg that's still not visible yet, that still really has to be exploited. It's much more than just weak passwords. And then, of course, the difficulty is many of these passwords, for example, cannot be changed by the users. So it's not users picking bad passwords or users not changing passwords. It's manufacturers, really, that build these support passwords or backdoors into these devices, and of course, they will eventually get discovered.
There's a certain amount of decentralized responsibility and authority here. Obviously, these are low-hanging fruit for cyber criminals or botnet operators. So how do you address this problem in a way that is holistic and that actually works and scales?
Well, really, it has to be addressed by the manufacturer. I think the user is really not in a position to fix this particular problem. I don't think you can really push the responsibility to the users, ISPs or such. It has to be something that manufacturers address.
And you're there at the Internet Storm Center. What are the trend lines on these types of scans and interest in these types of devices? Is this a relative to, you know, the overall malicious or suspicious traffic that you're seeing out there on the Internet?
Ever since Mirai came out, port 23 traffic, which is Telnet, has been our most scanned port. So it is right now the number one threat out there on the Internet.
Johannes Ulrich, always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Goodbye.